From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump had a different message about wearing masks last night during his first televised coronavirus briefing in months. The president acknowledged the pandemic will get worse before it gets better and urged Americans to wear masks to slow the spread of the disease, something he had resisted in the past.
Meanwhile, the clock is ticking on Congress, which has just days to approve more money for coronavirus relief before the extra unemployment benefits approved in March are set to expire. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is expected to unveil a proposal this week for another major spending package. But before haggling with Democrats, congressional Republicans are hitting a roadblock at the White House. So let's check in Washington with Everything just jumped around. Yes, with NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi, Robin.
Working from home.
Yeah, the magic.
So let's start with, is the White House holding firm on this payroll tax cut that the president wants? He's pushing for it to be in the bill, something that Republicans have rejected.
You know, it's been really interesting to watch the way the White House has messaged this. We heard from the president that he wouldn't rule out, you know, vetoing or rejecting a bill that doesn't have a payroll tax cut. But the way we understand it, it wasn't a major part of the conversations when White House staff went to the Capitol this week. So we're not exactly sure where that stands. It is possible that maybe this could go away like it did in the last round of negotiations.
Well, Mitch McConnell has said any new spending package will be less than the $2.5 trillion CARES Act passed in March. So what's the latest on what that might include?
We know Republicans are asking for $105 billion for schools to help them reopen, and they want legal liability protections to prevent a slew of COVID-related lawsuits. McConnell was really careful to point out that this isn't just about protecting businesses, but also schools and hospitals and individuals who, you know, might want to move further along in reopening or in interacting with other people but don't want to get sued. We are also understanding that this is just a starting point. McConnell told reporters that it's likely another round of direct payments would be included here, but he wants Republicans to have a unified place to start negotiations with Democrats.
Right, and talk about those $600 a week payments. Congress has until the end of next week to pass an extension of this extra unemployment insurance that's been helping so many people. What's the latest on whether congressional Republicans might join Democrats in extending them?
I found it really interesting that when McConnell was back home in Kentucky over the past few weeks, he signaled a willingness to talk about unemployment benefits. He has said all along that he's opposed to extending that $600 that you mentioned. He's saying that the federal government is basically paying people to stay home and not go to work. So there is a willingness to talk about doing unemployment benefits, but the question is how much? Democrats want that unemployment, but they haven't set a red line on how much it should be. And there's a lot of support among Democrats for extending unemployment, but there isn't uniform agreement on how or how much. So I would watch for that number to be flexible.
Now, what about the timing? Because we mentioned the benefits expiring at the end of July. Congress has one more week after that until their scheduled recess, August 7th. So how, you know, given the timing, how likely will there be a deal? I mean, is it possible in this, you know, political moment that they could pass nothing?
It is certainly possible, though I will say that Congress loves a deadline. They typically don't get anything done until the very last minute when it seems like they're rushing and maybe have to work through the weekend. I will also say that Congress is pretty well known for missing, you know, the deadline they set for themselves and then having to retroactively apply policies so that maybe it will look like people's unemployment lapse, but then maybe they'll go back and give people the money retroactively. So there's a lot in flux at this moment, and I think we'll know more once Democrats and Republicans come to the table together.
Well, meanwhile, Kelsey, very briefly, what is the reaction to President Trump's pivot last night, saying that masks are good and things are going to get worse before they get better with the pandemic?
That is certainly welcome news for Republicans who have been up on Capitol Hill talking about masks for some time. We've been seeing particularly senators, Republican senators wearing masks, saying it's important. So it's a welcome change for them because they're hoping to get onto a unified messaging with this White House on a number of things, including masks.
Yeah, be interesting to see if that sustains. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
To the impacts of COVID-19 now and the service workers on the front lines bagging groceries, serving and delivering food, jobs that leave them vulnerable to the disease. In Los Angeles County, for instance, the number of COVID-19 cases are up dramatically at warehouses, retail stores, and manufacturing plants, and a significant percentage of those workers are Black, Latino, and Indigenous. One of those workers is Brian Ramian. He's a filmmaker and has also worked in the service industry for more than 20 years. He recently wrote about his experience for the LA Times. Brian is a Hashaman, part of the Indigenous community in San Juan Capistrano, California. And he joins me now. Hi, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
Brian, your op-ed lays bare some of your day-to-day interactions. The stories are really hard to read, but you say it's necessary that we hear them. You write that the restaurant industry culture too often allows for the diminishment of its workers by restaurant owners, managers, and the ever-demanding customers. Can you say more about what you mean?
For some reason, sometimes, and I'm not saying this as a blanket statement of all people, but when you're a customer, it feels like there's a bit of an entitlement. Some people saying, I need to be served. I missed this environment. And I get that. But this almost like, I need you to serve me. And I need this now. And sometimes that also includes the management, or in my experience, in some of the finer dining restaurants that I've worked in, the chefs that really mistreat their employees. But yeah, the consumer that comes in, when we pay for something, I feel like sometimes we feel like we can treat the person who's giving us that service with less respect just because they're on the clock and doing a job. And I see a lot of it, quite a bit.
And you detail some examples of how customers treat you. Your first night back at work at a dining establishment in Santa Monica, California, you served hundreds of people. Some, you say, wore masks, some did not. Tell us more about that experience.
Yeah, I'll tell you, those first few weeks, and I can really recapture those first few days going back to work, putting a mask on, and I'm sure a lot of people are experiencing this. When you are moving at a high pace, it's already extremely high stress with a high demand from a customer, a high demand from a chef, a high demand from a management, and you have 30 things that are inside of your mind that you're trying to micromanage and multitask with, and you have a shield that is quite literally an inch away from your eyes. It's hard to breathe, and people are bumping into you and talking and laughing, kind of laughing at you. I hadn't seen people or been around anybody besides my children and some very close family. And all of a sudden, I'm exposed to a lot of people, and it was difficult. And I had these massive headaches, and I had even like a small little panic attack that luckily I was able to manage while I was on the floor. There was too much going on to I don't know where you go have panic attacks while you're at work, but it was hard to deal with at first. It still is hard to deal with. I don't understand that we don't seem to have a collective care for one another inside other spaces. People's lives are at stake, or at least some people feel like their lives are at stake. And that's important to respect.
The restaurant you worked for closed in mid-March, then reopened in May. Was it a difficult choice to go back? Do you feel like you had to choose between your health and your bills?
When the restaurant came calling and said, hey, it's time for us. We get to open our doors back. I'll tell you, my first instinct was, I don't want to go back. I don't know what to expect. I've been asked to stay inside of my apartment. And there was a fear of being around people and then seeing my kids and like thinking about hugging them at the end of the day. And then you get into the financial question, like, what's that going to look like? That was like the last thing on my mind. And while I wanted to support the restaurant industry and I wanted to support people that are putting their lives out there and need to go back to work, because there are a lot of people that I work with that might not be able to get the federal assistance that some of us are getting.
Yeah. The state of California is now entering its second phase of shutdowns. The health czar is expected to make additional recommendations for businesses. But for so many people, as you said, they have no choice but to risk their health because they need to work. What would you ask for people to consider?
I think we need a restaurant revolution. I think we need a complete, I don't know, I'd love for people to think about infusing care and a little bit more thought in the things they do, we do, I do, with the people that you don't know out in the world. Be kind. If you're sitting down in a restaurant just be a little bit more aware of how you talk to people. And when you were looking across the table at a person who was taking your order and filling your water and bringing you that cocktail, and the busboy who is making sure that he is wiping down and sanitizing all of the spaces inside of the restaurant, be a little bit kinder. And that can stretch from employee to employee, from manager to employee, from employee to manager, from the chef and to the owners, if we could just be a little bit more conscious about how we treat each other and that we are putting our lives at risk.
Brian Ramian is a filmmaker in Southern California. He's also worked in the service industry for more than 20 years. We'll link you to his LA Times op-ed at hereandnow.org. Brian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. You are amazing. Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
There's no doubt that depending on where you live, your ability to get a test and the amount of time it takes to get those results back vary wildly. And we've heard for months now that we can test and trace our way out of this pandemic. But both parts of that equation have proven to be incredibly challenging for the U.S. health infrastructure to manage. And right now, we want to focus on testing. There are reports that some COVID-19 test results have been delayed by a week or more. And local health officials say it's hampering their ability to respond to the virus. We have with us now Matthew Herper here to talk about why these test results are taking so long. He's a senior writer at Stat News. And Matt, demand for the tests are going up. Wait times are going up. Do you have any idea exactly how long people are waiting across the country?
Well, we don't really have great stats on how long people are waiting generally. But we do know that there are a lot of anecdotal reports of people waiting more than a week for test results when they just walked into a doctor's office and ordered a test. And that Quest, one of the big providers of diagnostic tests, has said that their average wait times are more than a week. It should be noted that if you're at a hospital, you're probably getting your test result back very fast. You may get it back in a day. You may get it back in a matter of hours. There are platforms that can give you a very rapid return. But we are seeing big delays in how long it takes people to get tests.
Yeah, again, it's anecdotal, but we actually have a producer on Here and Now who has waited for 2 weeks for test results and still haven't gotten them back yet. Where's the bottleneck? Why do some of these tests come back really quickly? You mentioned hospitals have access to return those results more quickly, but why are others taking so long?
Well, the thing that you have to understand here is it's not actually the test. It's not the machine that runs the test that takes so long. Mm-hmm. It's that swab has to go from your urgent care to Quest, and it has to get from one place to another, and then it sits waiting while we wait for the machine to have capacity to run that test. Mm-hmm. So that's simply why there's a delay. What's the bottleneck? There are probably a lot of bottlenecks, but one mm-hmm. of the big ones is going to be machine capacity. Now, manufacturers have said that they have capacity to do millions of tests. U.S. is currently doing 700,000 to 800,000 tests a day. But a lot of the problem is making sure that you can get the sample to the right machine at the right time and get it back to people. And it's a logistical problem. And the system isn't doing very well with it for people who are, you know, not hospitalized.
How much does this also have to do with the failure of electronic health records? This has been a long-standing issue in healthcare.
Well, I have heard that it's a problem, not just electronic health records, but insurance networks, and that when it's not just a matter of doing a test and getting that result back to an office, but who's hooked into your EHR, who is the preferred test provider for your hospital or urgent care, as the case may be. And there have been suggestions, particularly the Rockefeller Foundation has made a lot of suggestions on testing. And one of the early ones was that there are a lot of labs that are not hooked into the systems of some healthcare providers, and that fixing that might unlock a lot of test capacity.
Back at the beginning of this pandemic, as we know, I mean, we were really struggling with testing, in part because there just weren't enough tests. And manufacturers were just gearing up to make some different kinds of tests. Is that still a problem anymore in any parts of the country?
We clearly don't have enough tests running to deal with the surge in cases. And that's a real problem because there could be an even bigger surge of cases coming. And being able to test people and tell them to self-isolate is one way to control the spread of coronavirus, particularly if you can test people who are asymptomatic and get them results quickly. A lot of new tests have come on board. A lot of the manufacturers have introduced new technologies and different machines that all use the same basic process called polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, for viral testing. But there are new tests called antigen tests, which may miss more cases, but they also could be very cheap. And you could use them to give to people who are asymptomatic and test people a lot so that you'll catch more cases and reduce spread. And that idea is out there. Those tests aren't being made widely available. Again, the Rockefeller Foundation has suggested that the government should be looking to buy millions of those tests and distribute them to people as a way of trying to slow the spread of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. New technology can definitely play a role here, but there's also an organizational component, which seems to be a big part of where we're falling down as a country.
Right, exactly. I mean, in other countries seem to have this down. I mean, can you paint a picture of what a well-developed national testing system would look like?
Well, Germany did very, very well, right? I mean, certainly Iceland and New Zealand, which also have the advantage of being islands, did very well. And in some places, they were testing everybody who entered into a building. PCR, the technology used for most of these tests, was invented here. A lot of these rapid tests are made by manufacturers here. But what a lot of countries did very early was put a lot of resources into making sure that the testing was there. And then that there were procedures for isolating people, including giving people hotel rooms if they test positive, so that they have somewhere to stay that's not with family, which is where a lot of the transmission seems to happen. I think that one of the big things to think about here is it's not about, you hear the argument a lot that, well, the U.S. is doing more testing than all these other countries, and it's true. And the problem isn't just how much testing do you have, it's how do you get the testing to stay in front of the virus. And the problem is we've been playing catch up for the whole time.
This has to be frustrating for public health experts. You've heard from them. What are they talking about the consequences, really, of these delayed test results?
Well, there's really a Groundhog Day element for a lot of them, because they do keep, you hear all these other ideas and they keep saying, yes, but testing, 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 testing. Now, the NIH is doing a lot of work to help particularly small companies that are developing some of these tests to move faster. But there's kind of a general sense of people being frustrated because it's not exactly clear. It's not like there's one single thing that you can do that fixes the problem. It's just clear when you hear that people are waiting 7 to 10 days or 2 weeks for a test. That's not a test that's very useful to that person or to public health. At 2 weeks, that person's time when they should have been self-quarantined is over, right? Like, that's how long you're supposed to self-isolate if you test positive.
I'm also thinking about public perception, because, I mean, if these tests take too long to come back, if you know this about the community in which you live, that the place that you'd go to get the test takes forever, there could be fear that people will stop going to get tested.
Well, absolutely. And beyond that, the point of having everyone get tested is to get the results back and have them self-isolate. And we did see here in New York when things got bad, we saw, you know, people were told, well, if you have symptoms, stay home, right? You stop mm-hmm. testing people.
Right. That had been the really message. Bad. Yeah.
And, you know, that means that you've given up on having this tool to control spread. And it is a pretty powerful tool. I mean, if you could test everyone regularly, that would take the place of contact tracing. You'd need a lot of tests to do that. But having large volumes of tests that return results in a reasonable amount of time is a very powerful tool for controlling a virus. But you need a lot of testing to do that. And if it's taking 7 days, it kind of doesn't count for that purpose.
Right. Do you see any indication that we will make our way out of this in a way that allows people to get tests fast and to get a handle on the pandemic?
There are a lot of things going on that could help, particularly what I mentioned about the work the NIH is doing and the work that companies are doing, that if we get a lot of cheap, rapid tests that are accessible, people just using those themselves, even if the government isn't buying them for them, could have a big impact. There's a really big, there's been some news headlines about Republicans in Congress trying to get more funding for testing and there being some difficulties with the Trump administration around that. The Rockefeller Foundation says that we probably need to invest $75 billion in order to get testing up to where it needs to be, and that's also a bargain considering the huge impact that this virus has on the economy when it's allowed to get out of control. So there are a lot of things that could be done, and there's a lot of technologic progress being made, which could, as often happens in American healthcare, we could have amazing innovations which save us, and that's all on the table. But it's surprising to be talking about long wait times for tests when that was something we were going to fix back in April.
Matthew Herper is a senior writer at Stat News, talking with us about the delays in COVID-19 test results throughout the country. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
Question for you out there. Have you all been waiting a week or more for your COVID-19 test results? Tell us at hereandnow.org. The notion that racism is a public health crisis has taken hold in communities across the country. But how will those communities back up their statements about fighting racism with action? WCPN Ideas Stream, Nick Castell, has the view from Northeast Ohio.
The declarations don't lay out new policies, but they do list disparities in health that hit Black communities harder, like life expectancy, infant mortality, and lead poisoning. And they point to research in social determinants of health, the idea that what kind of neighborhood one lives in affects access to fresh food, good housing, jobs, and ultimately one's well-being. Councilwoman Veronica Sims sponsored a health crisis measure in Summit County, Ohio, where the Black infant mortality rate was more than twice the rate for whites in 2018, according to the state health department. She says it's not a one-and-done proposition.
This is just not one big feast, right? And so we're going to all get together and eat, and then it's over. It's something that needs to go on until we accomplish the goal of dismantling structural and systemic racism.
The tumultuous events of 2020 have given momentum to the issue, says Professor Ronnie Dunn of Cleveland State University. The impact of COVID-19 on people of color, the shutdowns of economies, the video of a police officer kneeling on George Floyd's neck, all of it has added up in public opinion, he says.
People being sheltered at home and almost held virtually captive audiences with their children there. I think that made this a very different moment in history.
Now the question for cities and counties is what comes next? Just as emergency declarations come before disaster relief, Dunn says health crisis resolutions should lead to investment in people hurt by racial discrimination.
We've been remiss to address them in their individual sectors, in criminal justice, in education, in housing. So I think looking at it from the health perspective is an astute strategy.
Some are looking beyond government action, too. Cleveland City Councilman Bashir Jones says private institutions need to be involved.
So whether it's hospitals, whether it's banks, we want to see something tangible happen to show us that you truly believe that these practices have had an impact.
That means reversing discriminatory practices and elevating more Black people to management roles, he says. Jones spoke at a news conference hailing the passage of Cleveland's public health crisis resolution. So did Kristen Farmer, the president of Birthing Beautiful Communities, a nonprofit that works with expecting Black mothers. She says it's not enough to hold more conversations about racism without following through with action and resources.
Oh, I think that a lot of times it is a way to make people feel like they're doing something without them actually having to be accountable to do something.
For Farmer, doing something means spending money on what she calls Black infrastructure. That is, African-American organizations that are of and for the communities they serve. She says these declarations can't just be trends.
Because it'll come back to bite you. Because when it's time to be held accountable, what are you really doing for your Black citizens?
That's the question community leaders say they'll now try to answer. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Castell in Cleveland.
School officials, as we've been hearing, are struggling to figure out what school will look like in the fall as coronavirus cases continue to spike. And there are lots of things to consider. For instance, the Government Accountability Office recently reported that 41% of school districts nationwide have heating and cooling systems that need to be upgraded or replaced. And last week, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine said the pandemic has worsened disadvantages for Black, Latino, and Indigenous children, and that they should be prioritized as part of reopening plans. Keisha Scarlett is Chief of Equity, Partnerships, and Engagement in the Seattle Public School System and a contributor to this latest report, and she joins us now by phone. Hi, Keisha.
Hello.
You know, Seattle Public Schools, like many school districts, have had problems in recent history with making certain that all students receive an equitable education, Black, Brown, Indigenous students, as well as other students. And so I just want to know how this COVID-19 crisis possibly exacerbates what's already a major fault line within Seattle public school systems and others as well.
You know, Seattle Public Schools, like many districts, have really struggled to close opportunity gaps and to really acknowledge the historical legacies of racism in this country and how our educational systems were not intended for children of color, and particularly Black children and Indigenous students, to succeed. And so this is intergenerational and historical racism that needs to be faced by all school districts. What I will say about Seattle schools is, you know, we just adopted a bold new strategic plan that really focuses on our students furthest from educational justice and focuses on what we call a targeted universalism strategy, in particular looking at African-American males and just thinking about if our system can be coordinated to ensure that African-American males are successful, then it helps to move all students forward. And so maybe in contrast in some ways, I think that we were a little bit more ambivalent about some of the decision making in this new strategic plan. But actually, COVID has forced us to really apply our racial equity lenses. We have a COVID-19 racial equity analysis tool that we've applied to resource allocation in some other areas. So in some ways, I think it's forced us as a school system to really try and enact out the values that we wrote into that document. And that's the work that it's going to take. It's going to take us to move into doing equity work instead of just talking about it and writing about it.
So I want to make a point to say that there are also white students who are disproportionately affected by schools possibly not reopening in the fall. But numbers show that Black, Latino, and Native American children are disproportionately impacted. Can you talk about maybe your fears about them being further behind without additional help if schools do not open?
You know, I think some of the fears of not having in-person learning, the first one is belonging and the importance of adults. I think it's really important mm-hmm. that adults and trusted adults play a key role in sort of unlocking the opportunities of equitable education, and they really start with those relationships that are built. So that is a concern. Families don't have necessarily equitable access to technology if they're sharing devices throughout the house and don't have individual student devices and laptops. Those are all barriers that just exacerbate sort of those opportunity gaps that exist for these students as well.
What have you been hearing from parents and students?
A lot of frustration. You know, there are families who really want their children to come back and be in person for learning, feel ill-equipped to provide the homeschooling and home learning that they were thrust into. No one had any time to plan for this. And I've heard a lot from second language families just about communication barriers, those families that need in-language access to information. I think there's just some huge communication gaps that yet exist. And we've heard a lot from students about how much they miss the physical presence of school. We've just heard a whole lot from community. And then lastly, just having the basic needs in order to take care of themselves.
Hmm. Keisha Scarlett is Chief of Equity, Partnerships, and Engagement in the Seattle Public School System. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, the late Paul Bartel was a prolific actor, writer, and independent filmmaker who directed the cult classics Eating Raoul, Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, and Death Race 2000. His last film, Shelf Life, was critically acclaimed but never distributed. As John Kalish reports, after sitting on a shelf for a quarter century, it's about to have a new life.
Shelf Life begins with the St. Cloud family descending into its underground bomb shelter on the day in 1963 that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
I knew this would happen sooner or later. This is just the beginning. It's only a matter of time before they take over everything.
The rest of the film takes place 30 years later, with the surviving three children still in the bomb shelter, cut off from the rest of the world. It began as a stage play created by the three actors in the film, Jim Turner, Olan Jones, and Andrea Stein.
I think we were quite taken with the idea of, what if we were sequestered? What do people do when they don't have outside influences and they are forced to create a life and a culture and relationships?
Want to play plates and dogs? Law enforcement? Ballerinas?
Ballerinas! Ballerinas. Oh, no! Medical update that always ends in tears. How about climb every mountain?
Personal tragedy? Monsters who cheat?
No.
The movie was released in 1993. Director Paul Bartel caught the final performance of the play and decided right away that he wanted to film it, as he told me in 1994.
I was knocked out by all of the ideas. Ideas about the relationships between men and women, between siblings, the existence of the child within adults, all kinds of satirical and non-satirical comments on American culture, and an amazingly interesting situation.
Shelf Life was rejected by the Sundance Film Festival, a major disappointment for Bartel, who died in 2000 and had served on Sundance juries. Variety called the film Bartel's best directing to date, but he couldn't find anyone to distribute it. Fast forward a quarter century to Bartel fan Alex Mechanic, who got his hands on a bootleg VHS tape.
And it really just stands out as something that feels unique and hilarious and really heartfelt, too. And I think it's time for people to see it. And I feel, just based off the reactions we've gotten so far, I do feel that there are people out there that would really want to see this and would really respond to it.
2 years ago, mechanics screened Shelf Life for a group of 20 and 30-something Hollywood creatives, and last year, sold-out screenings were held in Los Angeles, New York, Toronto, and Seattle.
Thank you for being here with us on this gorgeous Seattle day. We're about to go down, down, down into the dark.
29-year-old Elle Fried attended the Seattle screening and then watched it again this spring when the Northwest Film Forum moved to screening online because of the pandemic. She says the film's absurdist humor appeals to people her age, especially during this historical moment.
I think that it's absolutely prescient. We're stuck in houses for an indefinite amount of time. We are living in this crazy, just surreal world.
Actor Olan Jones, who portrays Tina St. Cloud, thinks there's another reason the film's characters appeal to audiences who are sheltering in place.
In New York, there was this girl about 19 or 20. She was over the moon after she saw it. And I said, why do you like Shelf Life so much? And she said, this is our lives. We're all living in a bomb shelter.
Last night, they shot President Kennedy. Now, we are going to stay down here where it's safe until the Martians or the communists or whoever the hell did it goes away. The kids are little. They will adapt.
The actors who created Shelf Life and Paul Bartel's family are close to signing a deal to release the film as a DVD and online. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
Meanwhile, Shelf Life will be screened today on the American Cinematheque website. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. And for this week's Senate Tracker, we turn to Oregon, where incumbent Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley is facing off against the state Republican Party-backed candidate Joe Ray Perkins, a financial advisor and a self-proclaimed follower of the completely false QAnon conspiracy group, which believes that a deep state and the government made up of pedophiles and Satanists is plotting against President Trump, that Hillary Clinton is running a child sex abuse ring in a D.C. pizzeria. Again, completely false. The FBI has labeled QAnon a potential domestic terrorism threat. And yesterday, Twitter said it will ban associated content and links and has taken down 7,000 accounts associated with QAnon. But President Trump has retweeted messages from QAnon promoters, and at least 11 Republican congressional candidates across the country have voiced approval or support of QAnon conspiracy theories, as Perkins has in Oregon. Jeff Mapes is a senior political reporter at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Jeff, we should say that Senator Jeff Merkley is expected to win this race, right?
Oh, yes, quite handily.
But let's take a listen to Republican Joe Ray Perkins. Here is some sound from her recent ad.
I need your help to unseat the very liberal, far-left, progressive Senator Jeff Merkley. Now, I am 100% confident that we can send a Republican senator to Washington, D.C. from Oregon.
Jeff, based on what? What is she campaigning on?
Very much on the idea that he is just, as she said in the ad, too far to the left. And, you know, she is very much reflecting the anger of a lot of small town and rural Oregon, upset at the shutdowns of economic activity because of the coronavirus pandemic. And also, you know, the Democratic leadership of the state that has really shifted the state politically to the left. You know, you also have the quite vigorous protests over police brutality in Portland. That's created something of a split in the state. Oregon in the rural areas can get quite conservative, and they're frankly in the minority in this state. So there's a lot of anger to be gathered there, but it typically doesn't take you to victory.
Well, and she's not at all shy about her support of QAnon. She said in a video on Twitter after winning the primary in May, I stand with President Trump. I stand with Q and the team. Thank you, Anons. Thank you, Patriots. Together we can save our republic. What else has she said about her belief in this? Really, you know, it might sound silly, But we remember that a man took up a gun and actually went to that pizzeria in Washington, D.C. because he believed there was a child sex ring in the basement run by Hillary Clinton, which was a QAnon theory. A lot of people could have gotten hurt there. So it's also potentially deadly serious. What does she say about it?
Well, you know, a little bit she's trying to have it both ways. I mean, she says that, yes, she is interested in what gets posted on QAnon sites. She often uses as a resource. But at the same time, she says, it's just another source of information for me. I have a lot of different sources of information. And a lot of times they're just posing questions and things that ought to be investigated. So she really kind of tries to play it down more. She would really rather talk more just about having a conservative political philosophy, not so much her links to QAnon.
Well, and then there's the Democratic Senator Merkley, who's held the seat for over 10 years. Here he is speaking Monday with KATU2 TV in Portland about federal law enforcement actions against demonstrators in Portland.
You can't just send in federal troops with no cooperation and no invitation with the governor or mayor and start marching them through the streets, and particularly in this aggravated secret format where you can't tell a camouflaged police officer from a camouflaged right-wing activist.
Tell us more about what he's doing to position himself.
On this particular issue, in terms of the police protests, and this really is very reflective of virtually every elected official, certainly on the Democratic side, but the governor of the state, the mayor and other city officials in Portland, the other Democratic members of the Congress, they're all saying this is federal overreach and frankly is making things worse, and that this is not at all helpful for the city. And frankly, they think that the president is doing it hoping to send a political message to the rest of the country, to his supporters, saying, look at all this crazy stuff that is happening in Portland. You don't want it coming to your community. I'm trying to stop it.
Do you expect any of the top candidates, you know, President Trump or former Vice President Biden or any of their surrogates to come to the state to campaign? Or is it, you know, if it's considered that it's Merkley's race to win, do you see any Republicans coming to stand up with Perkins?
No. In fact, some of the candidates, even in Oregon, who are running for other offices have distanced themselves from her. The recent campaign finance reports that came out shows, you know, really that she's getting very little money, only has something like $5,000 in the bank right now. Well, Jeff Merkley has $3.6 million. And frankly, it was because no real name Republicans stood up to run against Jeff Merkley this time that she was able to win the nomination.
Jeff Mapes, senior political reporter at Oregon Public Broadcasting, with our tracking of the Senate race there. Jeff, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Richard Nixon's silent majority referred to Americans who didn't protest or express their opinions publicly. President Trump has adopted the phrase, but historians say 2020 isn't 1968.
The silent majority was an attempt to kind of occupy the middle. But of course, Trump is not the middle.
The silent majority. That's next time on Here and Now.